There was once a great American named George Henderson. He met a woodland ape, or Sasquatch, and despite its dangerous message of environmentalism, became his friend. But when the time came to do the hard thing and send it back into the forest where it belonged, and birds could perch on its shoulder because it was gentle, George Henderson summoned the strength, and by God, he did it. Did it hurt? You bet it hurt. Like a bastard. But he did it because it was the right thing to do. For the woodland ape. You think better.
What?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Is that Harry and the Hendersons?
You've seen it.
This is my life, Jack.
I thought it was an interesting sort of, but not altogether unsurprising turn of events then. The movie becomes a huge success. And Smokey, who was like a critical part of sort of facilitating a lot of the local aspect of it, as well as the people in Folk who either participated in the movie or even people who were just affected by the influx of tourists who wanted to see the area, I got the impression they sort of felt slighted by all this and kind of taken advantage of, because this became like a huge hit, and Charles Pierce kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, sort of like just took the money and ran. You know, he was like, this is a great success, but he never really kind of turned around and helped these people out or repaid anybody as far as, you know, there weren't like residuals or anything for any of these folks, right?
Right. Yeah, and that was unfortunate. And, you know, Smokey has been the most outspoken person about that. He actually sued Charles Pierce for some money that he felt was owed. That court case went on, and Smokey was really mad about it, and rightly so in a lot of regards. I mean, but some of the people in the town, you know, was like, hey, cool, I'm in a movie. They didn't care. I mean, and I think the mayor was quoted as saying, you know, nobody really expected anything to happen with it. I mean, it's great that it did, but nobody, I mean, this is a guy who's never made a movie, you know, about a Bigfoot creature. I mean, nobody really expected anything to happen. They just underestimated it would become a phenomenon like it did. And so, you know, once money starts playing into the picture,
right,
of course, you know, some people are like, hey, man, we should have got money. And, you know, I see both sides. I mean, Charles Pierce is the one that just took, you know, picked up the camera and went down there and did it. And I mean, he was in debt over $100,000 by the time it was all said and done before he had put the movie out, you know, in this local, I mean, a local businessman down in Texarkana, you know, you need to pay them back. These are rough dudes. I mean, they are not playing around.
Yeah.
And Charles Pierce, I mean, he was sweating it big time. And, you know, he kind of won the lottery in a way on this thing, and I really think he should have donated some money to the town of Falk. That's really a shame that he didn't, but I can't speak for the guy. I don't know how much money changed hands exactly or whatever, so I'm coming at it from a fan's point of view, and I just look at Pierce's achievement, but I also document Falk and their troubles with this and everything, and that's understandable as well. It was just a crazy thing, the whole deal.
Right, exactly. Yeah, like I said, it's unsurprising that, you know, when it becomes an unexpected hit, then it becomes acrimonious between all parties involved, because, you know, like you said, the mayor, I think he said something along the lines of, like, this, you know, this is a movie made by a guy who's never made a movie, funded by a guy who's never funded a movie, and acted in by actors, by people who've never even been in a movie. So it was like, who would have thought that this thing would have turned out to be so huge anyway?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I found that in my, you know, as I've gotten to know a lot of folks up there, I really haven't found anybody that's been too angry about it. You know, the younger generation seems always proud. You know, my grandfather was in the movie, or, you know, my brother wore the suit, or, you know, it's a source of pride for people. I mean, you know, Falk, it seems like I kind of have a love-hate thing going with this whole fame and well, not so much fortune of it. And, so, you know, there's a lot of social aspects to it, sociology and intrigue. It's got it all.
Yeah, well, I guess talk a little bit about that, because that's something interesting, because, you know, Fouke has a sort of interesting, you know, place amongst these towns and cities that have become paranormal hubs, if you will, you know, like Roswell or Point Pleasant, you know. How does the town feel about being, you know, a destination point for the paranormal? Because they're certainly not, you know, the size of Roswell or Point Pleasant. You said there's 800 people there now. So it's like, that's an even more paradoxical situation here where it's, do they have, you know, like a festival or anything like that, or are they kind of low-key about it?
Well, they do. They have had a Boggy Creek festival that they've had off and on. It struck me, you know, I've been up to Fouke, you know, I went up there several years back, and I'm trying to look around to see what there might be, and, you know, it's not totally apparent at first. You know, there's not a lot of big signs and so forth. There's a place called the Monster Mart, and that's really the only thing. They have a mural of the creature on the wall, and I went in there, you know, there's some newspaper clippings hanging on the wall. It just was sort of like, well, it wasn't a big tourist operation or anything, so they haven't, you know, whereas you look at Roswell and you see all kinds of shops with aliens and, you know, they milk it for all they can, and it's fun, that's great. Fouke hasn't really done that. I mean, some people have tried to make good on it. In the 70s, like a gas station owner, Willie Smith, you know, he made a lot of Fouke monster trinkets, and I've heard he made a lot of money on that, and that was great. And, you know, a lot of people just like, there's no such thing as a monster, and they just carry on with their daily life, you know.
Yeah.
So you get it from all sides, but I have noticed that since I've been going up there and stirring up interest in this whole thing, and I went in there recently, and in this little Monster Mart, the owner had made a whole new room and a whole new display. They painted a Fouke monster on the wall, put some like spooky trees in there.
Oh, nice.
I was like, wow. And then they're like, well, you know, you should do a book signing here. And so I'm like, well, yeah, it'd be great. So I've seen a little bit of a spark of interest. So I think the Fouke monster comes and goes in waves. And I think at this point, you know, they're kind of embracing the whole thing. And, you know, at least from what I can tell, people are happy. And a lot of people I've heard that a lot of people are excited about the book. So that's really cool.
Was the renovation at the Monster Mart inspired by your depiction of it in the book, where you said that it was just like a bulletin board with some fading newspaper articles on there, or had they not read that part yet?
Funny thing, they hadn't read the book. they did this of their own accord.
Oh,
you know?
Good.
So I thought, yeah, that's great. I mean, so I've since given a copy to the owner of the Monster Mart, and my book signing is coming up, so... well, by the time people hear this, it'll have happened, but I felt, you know, I as a guy who just is a fanboy about, you know, the Fouke monster and the whole phenomenon, and who's spent hours and hours researching all this stuff in libraries and, you know, out there in the woods, it's kind of an honor for me that I could even play a significant part in the history of this and inspire people to be proud of it. So it's really cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, in a lot of ways, what you're doing is tremendous because it separates sort of the fact from the fiction. Because as you point out in the book, and as we've talked about here, you know, the movie is a double-edged sword. I mean, it inspires a lot of people. It gets people excited about cryptozoology. It makes them want to look into this. But also, on a micro level, it sort of gives people and skeptics the license to say wrongly that, oh, it was all just a movie, and then dismiss it, when that's not the case at all.
Right. I'm glad that's going to be out so that people can get the whole picture, because, that people just really only know the proverbial tip of the iceberg in this case, I think, and so I'm really glad that I can just you know, get it out there to people who are interested and want to know and who want to know a cool story. And I feel like that's a good contribution to the Bigfoot world as a whole, really.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, that we've sort of dropped the B word here over the course of this conversation, but I found it interesting, and you point out they didn't even have any idea about Bigfoot, and it's interesting, too, that, you know, like in all the sighting reports and stuff like that throughout the book, you know, maybe up until like the later ones that are mentioned in the book, like you just don't see, this thing isn't described as a Bigfoot. Not like, you know, it's described like a Bigfoot, but it's not described as a Bigfoot. People aren't saying, oh, I saw Bigfoot. They're just saying they saw this creature, which makes, I think, even more potent as far as something worthy of looking at, because this isn't a small town where they're like, hey, let's invent our own Bigfoot. It's like, no, dude, they just have their own Bigfoot, you know, and unbeknownst to them. And later on, you know, in this modern age, we can kind of start to put the pushpins in the map and draw the lines, and we're like, okay, well, we got another Bigfoot down here.
Right. And I kind of intentionally wrote the book in a way to treat the creature as separate as I could.
Right.
You know, acknowledging that, of course, it could be part of a more universal species of something, which we collectively call Bigfoot. But yeah, I tried to paint a picture of it, of it unto itself, so that it was kind of what I had always envisioned. It was unique, and it was a creature that I didn't want people to put a lot of preconceived mental images of Bigfoots and apply that just to the foul monster. I wanted to paint a picture of the creature that emerged from his environment, that emerged from the sightings that these old timers had reported, and that way it kept it apart, so to speak, from the modern template of Bigfoot.
Right, because it's kind of becoming a more and as a cryptozoologist, I'm sure this will resonate with you. It's kind of becoming more acceptable or more, you know, endorsed idea that we're dealing with like multiple creatures here. If the Bigfoot exists and all these reports are accurate and all these flaps are accurate, it's very likely, you know, that whatever's up there in Oregon is not the same thing as down here in Arkansas. It's like we're dealing with things that are maybe part of the larger species or whatever, but are very different animals altogether, you know? Like lions and tigers, they're still big cats, but they're totally different animals.
Exactly, yeah, and that's I agree, and that's kind of the way I see it. You know, you've got skunk apes and Bigfoot and different areas, and it's, yeah, they can definitely be related, but they don't necessarily have to be one just universal creature, so it gives each of them, you know, evaluate each instance unto itself, you know.
Right. Now talk about this story about the massive skeleton, because I have issues with this, but I'll get to them. And you know, obviously, you know, I'm pro crypto, so I'm not, you know, I'm not. This isn't a gotcha situation, but I have issues with how this whole thing played out, I guess you could say. But talk about this story about the massive skeleton, because I feel like, and you note this in the book, that like even it was talked about, it was mentioned, they made a documentary about it. You know, a picture exists of it, or at least the feet of it. So this isn't like some huge secret, but then also it's shrouded in a tremendous amount of secrecy, and has long been discussed sort of in rumor and innuendo on Bigfoot forums, despite the fact that a lot of information was out there. And I feel like your book really sort of sets the record straight and adds just tremendous detail to this story so that it can, you know, maybe finally be put to rest, or at least seen in a clearer light. So I guess talk about this massive skeleton story or rumor and all that stuff that had sort of circulated for years, and now we know a little bit more about it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that definitely turned out to be a big, you know, an interesting tangent of the whole Falk monster phenomenon. And like you say, the skeleton is, I've seen the same things on forums, people taking wild guesses at it. Have you seen this? There's just really no information, even though it's sort of available. But it was hard for me to dig up, you know, everything on it. But I finally did find all the pieces, and try not to give it away too much here.
Right.
be tricky. But basically, I think my book finally covers every possible aspect of that. I looked at it objectively, and I got information from as many people as I possibly could to piece together the entire history of that thing. But I've actually seen it, and that's when I saw it, I didn't really have a lot of prior knowledge of it. I hadn't read any Smokey's books, and Smokey talks about it quite a bit. And when I saw it, I didn't know much, and my jaw was almost on the floor. I was like, what am I looking at? This is the craziest thing I've ever seen. I mean, it's spooky looking, it's creepy looking, and it looks like the carcass of some, you know, ape-like creature or some huge animal. And, you know, I'm not the only one that's been able to view it, and the people I talk to also seem to kind of know what it is or have theories about it as well. So it's just been a strange aspect of this. You can see I'm trying to.
Yeah, I was gonna cut you off there and say and say you're dancing here, but I understand.
I'm totally dancing.
Because let me sort of bail you out a little bit here. There's this mysterious skeleton. It was found in 1991-ish. It came into the possession of Smokey Crabtree, who cut a deal with these two guys who found it. And even though he put it on display for a while, then it went out of display, and it's sort of been hidden away, I guess you could say, for like the last 20 years-ish. But Lyle and people who have investigated this previously, like police departments and stuff, have come to a pretty good conclusion of what it is. And with that said, I think people can figure out what it isn't. And the problem I have here, is that okay? Was that good?
Yes, that was excellent.
That was teaser enough for folks to pick up the book,
yeah,
and find out what we're talking about. My issue here, with the whole thing, and with all due respect to Smokey Crabtree, I don't know him. I don't know him from Krabby Smoke Tree. So, you know, this is not a personal thing. But it's like, why is this guy still keeping this thing a secret after 20 years? I mean, I can understand maybe 5 years you want to hold on to it and wait for the DNA test to come out and stuff. But, like, 20 years, dude, first of all, the jig is up. It can't be a Bigfoot, man, because there's no way it would be sitting around for 20 years. Like, if it was a Bigfoot, it would be all over, man. You'd be a multimillionaire. You'd have the Bigfoot. So it's like, I feel like this guy, and again, I don't know him or anything, but I feel like he's sort of perpetuating the mystery for mystery's sake. Unbeknownst, I don't know why, because he's not apparently making any money off of having this thing in his garage or whatever it is. So I don't know, maybe enlighten me about all that. Straighten me out here. Because I was getting frustrated and confounded with all this, because it's like, if you really want to get to the bottom of this, we need to eliminate this stuff that is just clouding the whole mystery and not helping anybody, and to perpetuate this idea isn't really to the benefit of anybody, including Smokey Crabtree, because he doesn't appear to be making any money off of it, and it doesn't appear that there's any way to make any money off of it. And now I'm going to get off my soapbox here and and turn it over to you on that one.
Well, I'm glad you said that. That's a definite problem with this whole thing, and unfortunately, for those that know Smokey, he's a peculiar guy. I mean, he's a great guy, and he's contributed quite a bit to the Fout Monster history and research. It's a mystery to me why he is so reluctant to just do something with that skeleton, or, you know, let people examine it, or just do something or don't.
Right.
But he does keep that shroud of mystery going, and that's one reason that I wanted to just set the record straight. I wanted to put the whole story in one place. Now, he does cover all this stuff in his memoirs, a lot of it. Now, I went and talked to the sheriff, down there near Marshall where it was found, and, you know, I got the rest of the story, and I also got all the news reports. I got everything, you know, and that the documentary Hunt for Bigfoot, which sort of used that skeleton as its centerpiece, was worthless. I mean, it was just, I'm just looking at it thinking, I mean, are these people idiots? I mean, they're not even going about the investigation right, you know, and they're not getting the right people to comment on it. They're only getting one side. And so this skeleton's just been a, you know, a can of worms, and in a way, well, I mean, this brings another point. In a way, I kind of saw why no one else has written a book on this, because I'm in very dangerous territory by writing this book. I'm gonna piss off a lot of people.
Yeah,
I think, and you know, I was a little worried at first when I started trying to write the book. You know, I'm coming at it as an outsider, you know, but I'm just a journalist, and, you know, in this approach, and a researcher, and I wanted to lay out the story, and that's all I'm doing. I'm backing it up with interviews, and newspaper accounts, and other people's words, you know, and I just tell the story, but people get heated under the collar about that skeleton thing. I mean, people just have told me flat out that, you know, don't say anything about that skeleton, you know.
Why? So, why would they say, like, don't?
Well, I don't know. That's what I mean. It's like, it's pretty clear, the whole story. I just don't understand why we have to sort of keep pretending, basically, about the whole thing. And I've seen, you know, the forums and the questions about it, and I wanted to set it straight, because if I'm writing the history of the Thought Monster, well, that's a part of it, and I'm not going to avoid it. I'm not going to tell part of the story. I'm not going to tell one person's side of it. I'm going to tell the whole thing, and that's exactly what I did, and at great risk to my own well-being, but so be it. That was part of my job here. And so I guess I don't have an answer as to why Smokey keeps up the ruse with the whole thing. I really don't. And I mean, you know, in defense of Smokey, he's getting on in years. He's, you know, he's not a, you know, he's had some health issues and stuff. And I think that the Fount Monster for him has been a blessing and a curse, you know, but I wish he'd just give me the skeleton and be done with it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'll do something with it, whether I just let people see it freely and you know.
Pack it up in a crate, send it to Lauren Coleman up in Portland so it can be put on display in the museum and you know, put an end to this.
There you go. Yeah, even that. And it should be out there for people to see, and I hope that someday myself or another guy, another friend of mine, could get a hold of it. It would be awesome. Maybe that would happen. I fear that it'll be junked and thrown away because it is hidden and it's treated sort of like just to keep up the shroud of mystery. It's just been hidden away. It's a strange thing.
Yeah, yeah. Maddening is the word I would use to describe it.
Yeah, just maddening. I mean, you can tell. I mean, when I'm talking, I'm just like, I don't know. It's hard to. I just don't know what to explain about it. It's something that I can't explain, you know.
Right, right. It's frustrating. And like I said, I mean, this would be, it would be permissible to me personally if this was like something that popped up like 2 or 3 years ago. It's like, okay, I understand you want to sit on it, but it's like, dude, 20 years later, let it go, man. You know, set the skeleton free, dude. There's not even a picture of this thing. Like, come on. This is right. Ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, if I would have put a picture of that thing in, in my book. I mean, you know, I better have a lot of money prepared to defend myself in court, because
yeah,
it would have been, I mean, I'm already at risk here. But
now, what do you mean? You've said that a couple times now. Like what?
Well,
like some Southern justice here, that kind of thing.
Well, no. I mean, I don't think I'll be hanged or anything.
All right.
You know, there's been a lot of money issues back and forth, and this plays into, even crosses over into the movie The Creature from Black Lake. The guy, the McCulloughs, that made that movie, they own part of the skeleton, or did own part of the skeleton. Smokey owned part of it. There's all these parties that, quote unquote, own part of it for some bizarre reason. To me, if you're going to own it, either you display it or make money on it, or just shut up. But, you know, yeah, there's other people at play in here that, for some reason, want to keep that thing as if it's like a, you know, an alien body from Roswell, when we know it's not.
Right, right. That's the thing. Yeah, I'm sending you a picture of they just found a mammoth skeleton that it was just ironic that it came up in today when I was reading the book, because it looks actually, if you cut the head off, it looks kind of what I imagine this thing looks like. But
there.
But yeah, it's frustrating. You hit the nail on the head, though. It's like it. I'm sure to the rumor mill and to people who just hear about it, they imagine it almost like this Roswellian alien that's tucked away, hidden somewhere. But it's like if an average person had an alien body, again, I go back to this, 20 years, man, you know?
Yeah.
It's like that's why I really applaud you. I mean, you're on the side of truth. And that's what this program's about, and that's what these listeners want, you know? They don't want someone coming on here telling some shadowy story about a mysterious skeleton that surfaced, but we don't know exactly what the story is. I mean,
right.
The story's in the book, folks, Beast of Boggy Creek. So go out and get it. But we wanted to also, I don't want to leave people sort of, I don't want to mislead people is the best way to put it. So, you know.
Right.
And like I said, I found my blood boiling as I read that part of the book.
I'm glad to hear that feedback. And yeah, it's, and I did. I wanted to put the truth out there because, really, I mean, it's a fascinating, strange story no matter what the thing is. I mean, it was still a cool story. And,
right.
And I don't even have to make, you know, I could have upheld all kinds of mystery about this and that. But, you know, I'm just laying it out there. Here's the story. Here's what it is. It still makes for interesting reading without me having to, yeah, fudge anything or do anything. I wanted to tell the complete truth because I've been standing in a room with very extremely highly prominent Bigfoot researchers, people that everybody knows, and I've heard this subject come up with this skeleton, and I could see how nobody knew the complete story, and I'm just sitting there going, why are we even talking about this thing? It's just forget it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's because there's been so much misinformation and no information that it's considered to be some viable evidence. But, yeah, hopefully now I'm just glad that now the book's out, everybody can just read it for themselves, and now we can move on.
Exactly. Now, to sort of tie a bow on the Fauk monster and the Beast of Boggy Creek, in a sense, you know, contrary also to what people may think, you know, there was this flap in the early 70s, and before that, the flap in Jonesville, but, you know, the monster didn't go away. You know, people may think, okay, well, this is an isolated thing that happened. It was a frenzy. It was maybe mass hysteria, and then nothing ever happened again. Like, these reports continued onward into the 80s, 90s, and the aughts, right?
Right, yeah. Most people had that impression. Oh, that all happened back in the 70s. That was cool, you know? And, you know, when going into it, you know, I pretty much had that belief as well because, you know, it had gotten so much attention in the 70s and movies, and then they started making crappy sequels. You know, now it's just laughable. So it kind of backfired, and any further sightings didn't really get the same respect or coverage as they once did. So in order for me to detail all the sightings that have happened since. You know, I had to go up there. I had to talk to people and do a lot of personal research to get the stories. And what I discovered is, in fact, there's been many sightings since then that were, even in my opinion, more compelling than the early ones. You know, I've got sightings, and a really good sighting in 1981. A young man saw it in Jonesville, you know, which I personally interviewed this guy. This will be the first time that story's out. I've got, in 1991, there was two sightings in which more than five people saw the thing at one time.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. I mean, and that was in a short period of time. And I talked to two witnesses out of five that saw it in this one instance. And, you know, those sightings in the 90s were amazing. There's several more. And then, you know, I talked to the retired sheriff, Phillips, who was involved. He was there since the get-go in the 70s. And, you know, he told me about a lot of sightings in the 90s. He said, you know, people reported them. We just didn't run to the newspaper or anything, or, you know, there's no reason to. And they sort of got swept under the table. And so, you know, and I even talked to people who had sightings in the 2000s. A girl, there's one in my book, there was a sighting in 2010. And, of course, once the book comes out, now I learned of a sighting in 2011. So, whereas I thought there'd be no part two, I'm already thinking, oh man, this just, it never ends, man.
Yeah. So this thing is a presence down there. It wasn't just a one-time thing. It seems to be still in the thick of it, if you will. No pun intended, I guess you'd say.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
I thought it was interesting too. You sort of trace how it stands to reason that the creature would sort of move towards Fowlk from Jonesville as development went on. Where do you think this thing may be kind of lurking? Still in the general area, or is it maybe moved a few miles one way or the other? Is there, obviously, if you knew that, we'd bag one, but, I mean, how close do you think we are as far as, like, whereabouts it may be lurking now?
Well, it seems to me that the you know, there's been a lot of clearing of those forests up there over the years. They've put in another major highway. There used to be only Highway 71, which incidentally it was called the Monster Expressway for a while, which was, I thought was very cool. They name a highway a Monster Expressway. Who knows? And, but they put in another larger highway, and that cleared a lot of trees. From Fowlk. Jonesville's still very remote, but it's not like it was back in the day where you could just disappear into the woods and never see anybody for a week. So as you withdraw back from Fowlk and Jonesville, then you hit the Mercer Bayou and some of that swampy area, and then to the west, the Sulphur River Wildlife Management Area. I think that's where any animals would naturally retreat, large animals like this. And, you know, those areas are still, there's still a lot of very remote areas in there. And, you know, moving on down to East Texas is, you know, heavily forested. And it provides, in my opinion, a pretty wide range that something could move and exist. And so I think that you're just not gonna get as many sightings in Fowlk. It's not quite on the edge of the woods like it once was, but occasionally, you know, animals move, and apparently it's still been seen, you know.
Right. Well, it's always something to the idea, and you kind of mention it here in the book about how there seems to be a correlation of seasonal rainfall and sightings. And also, there's also, in my opinion, maybe the possibility of some kind of migratory pattern that we might want to look at as well. But I think that, you know, the more we kind of look at those things, the better off we are as far as figuring out where these things might be.
Oh, certainly. I looked into that rainfall. A lot of the townspeople, you know, who could recall a lot of these instances, they all said that as well. They would say, you know, I think that during heavy years of heavy rain, we had more sightings. You know, of course, this data was so old and stuff, I couldn't quite, you know, get a hold of everything to completely analyze it all.
Yeah.
Maybe at some point I could, but yeah, it seemed to be a viable theory, you know.
Yeah, that was tremendous. I mean, if I had the money and the wherewithal, I'd be sitting on a weather situation waiting for that kind of perfect storm, if you will. Again, no pun intended, and then head down there to start looking then. You know, at least that way you have some indicator that, you know, the time may be well to go look for it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, you certainly have better chances during those times.
So yeah.
Keep so all the advantage you could have.
If you're down there, folks, and it's raining a lot, get out into the woods and start looking for this thing.
That's right.
Just don't
be afraid.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid. The Falcon Monster is he's only hurt a few people.
And one sort of recurring thing I noticed, too, in the book is these stories of people who shoot at the creature. And, you know, what do you make of that? Is that, because part of it's like, you know, there's no signs of blood or anything like that. So part of me wonders if that's bravado, where it's like, of course I shot at the thing. You're not going to deny that you pissed, you know, you're not going to say you pissed your pants and didn't shoot at it. So you got to say something. So you're like, oh, I shot at it and ran away. Or there's something more to it. You raise the idea that maybe, you know, in one instance, somebody shot at it. I think it was, Lynn Crabtree with shotgun, but it was like a squirrel pellet, and maybe it didn't even affect the thing because of the thick fur. Although also, when you talk about shooting, you know, these Bigfoot-like creatures, then that raises the specter of the paranormal Bigfoot idea that you know, you can't shoot at it because it's not really something that can be shot. So I guess I'm throwing a lot of things into this bouillabaisse of a question, but what do you make of, you know, people shooting at the creature and what it might tell us about the actual entity?
Well, I think some of that was bravado. Some of the people who claimed to have shot at it 15 times or whatever, those particular folks are apt to exaggerate, I think. I mean, no disrespect to them or their families, but I think everybody would agree with me about those particular personalities. So, they're, you know, I don't think that the thing was shot at as many times as claimed. Now, Lynn Crabtree, I did have trouble reconciling that because I thought this kid can shoot a squirrel, you know, how can he miss, you know, something this large? But, you know, then you have to consider, well, squirrel shot, I mean, you know, if you shoot, you're using squirrel shot against a bear, I mean, they got the advantage on that. So,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of other little factors that go on here that I feel don't necessarily categorize it as any kind of totally paranormal entity that can't be shot at. I mean, I usually approach things as much as I can, and using my hunting background, I look at it as some sort of an animal, you know, a biological animal like anything else. It could have other adaptable features that make it more elusive and tougher. Who knows?
Right.
But I never found, you know, in all the shooting and all that stuff at it, I never really got the vibe that people were implying that it was able to disappear or anything like that, or that it was likely to even done that. In most of the times when it really could have been shot, like it was seen by this woman hunter in 1965, in most cases, everybody would, they couldn't determine if it was a man or an ape or just what it was, and so they were reluctant to shoot at it. You know, it doesn't matter how much people run their mouth. When you're not really sure, you might be shooting at a man, you know, you're going to think twice.
Right, right, because then you're in a whole mess of trouble.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, the times when there was good sightings, when it was a hunter sitting there in a tree stand or something, that it could have picked it off. You know, everything about their sighting was saying that, well, I couldn't quite, I thought it was a man, and then I realized it had fur, and by the time it's out of sight, you know, you just can't make that quick of a judgment to say, well, it's totally an ape, I guess. I'll shoot it, you know. By the time you can see it, it's gone, so.
yeah, exactly. It's like the whole idea of why people don't get pictures of these kind of things. It's like you really don't have the opportunity to, you only really have the time to process what you're seeing, and then that's over. By the time you process it, the moment's gone, so.
Yeah, it's difficult at best, even if you think you're ready and everything. These animal sightings happen often very fast, especially if it's a creature that really doesn't want to be seen and maybe a little more intelligent than the other animals. Yeah, your opportunity is so narrow.
Now, you mentioned your hunting background, and you also mentioned the long-standing debate in the cryptozoology field, the kill or no-kill. It's always a fun sort of topic for me to discuss with cryptozoologists when they come on the show. I personally lean a little closer to kill than no kill, in my opinion, because, you know, I consider the Bigfoot my nemesis, and I want this story to end in a positive way where we can actually, you know, have one and move on and, you know, live in a world where Bigfoot is real, and, you know, that's my dream, I guess you could say. So I lean, you know, I guess I won't outright endorse the kill aspect of it, but I certainly wouldn't begrudge anyone who did. I guess that's my point of view. But what's your take on this whole kill versus no-kill debate that still rages on in cryptozoology?
Well, me as a person, I don't try to impart the way I think on others, so I'm cool with whatever anybody wants to do. I'm not going to tell them otherwise. For me personally, you know, I probably wouldn't shoot at it just simply because, you know, if I see it, that's good enough for me. I may think otherwise after I've seen it, but I don't really need to prove it to the world. If I see it, I'm good with it. But yeah, if you're talking about trying to end the debate, then obviously that's never going to end unless there's an actual body. I mean, I don't care what kind of clear picture you take. It'll be that'll be debated on the internet forever.
Yeah.
Unless the body's the only way to do it. And, you know, I'm aware of that. So, I don't, I've been a hunter, you know, most of my life, and, you know, I'll be glad to shoot a turkey and gobble it up. But, you know, I probably wouldn't go out and shoot some, exotic game in Africa just to get a trophy on my wall, because I just don't care about that kind of stuff. So
right, that's a whole different kettle of fish. You know, like I wouldn't shoot a rhino because we know rhinos are real. There's no
right.
There's no point in that. But I feel like if I was in the mix and one, and you know, and a Bigfoot crossed my path, I don't know. I feel like I'd be compelled to. But you know, quite honestly, and you know, as self-deprecating as it is, I'll admit it, folks, I'm very likely to also piss my pants. So, you know, I can't totally mock Lynn Crabtree. I can't totally mock the guy in the story earlier for his antics, because it's very likely that the same fate would have befallen me in that situation.
Yes, you would be the Bobby Ford of your time. I'm cool. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, and what I, you know, there's so much debate and hot wind going on about kill or no kill. I'm like, well, nobody's shot one yet, so, you know, I'm not going to waste a lot of time with deciding if they're, what the intelligence level or how much like a man they are. I don't know. I mean, we'll never answer that. It's until one's brought in, so.
Yeah, that's exactly, you make a good point, you know. No one's actually shot it yet, so what, you know.
Yeah, it's got the advantage, so. You know, even if people don't agree with somebody who's, you know, running around actually trying to kill it, well, so far nobody's killed it, so we don't have much to worry about, so, you know.
Right. I can almost guarantee, too, that, you know, in the event that someone did shoot it, they would be completely unaware of this kill or no kill debate. I think it would be a completely separate, you know, someone third party, completely uninvolved in the cryptozoology community who just pops the thing, you know, out of self-defense or accidentally or whatever, you know. So it's almost a moot point because I really don't think that anyone in the cryptozoology community would really do that necessarily, or at least I think that if it happened, it wouldn't be someone in the cryptozoology community. And the stories about this creature, too, and how people see it, you know, when they're driving around, in a sense, it almost makes you wonder if, like, if the Falk monster and Boggy Creek beast, you know, if it's almost like a prime candidate for the more benign situation where a lot of people say, you know, well, someday someone's going to hit one of these things with their car, and that's going to be how this whole thing bursts open. I have a feeling that if that happens, that area is a prime candidate for that kind of thing to happen, because it seems like it's crossing a lot of roads, and that's where a lot of the sightings are, and, you know, accidents happen.
Oh, yeah. It loves to cross roads, apparently, so it's playing with its own fate right there. So
right.
I mean, I had a sighting recently where it came about 3 feet from getting hit by a car, so it seems to be edging closer. It's, I don't know if it, some of those creatures' judgments are lacking, but yeah, we might just well have one get run over in the road not too long in the future.
Yeah, so, you know, that's the impression I got from reading the book, that it's like, well, that definitely could happen down there, because it seems like, you know, you have two instances, as you said earlier, where, you know, you got cars coming in opposite directions, and this thing crosses the road between them. It's like, this thing's just playing in traffic now.
Totally. It must have a death wish. I don't know, man.
Yeah. Now, you're well more aware of the geography of the area. What are the possibilities that this creature is somehow connected with the swamp ape of Florida?
To me, I've always felt that the swamp ape, skunk ape in Florida is more, always seemed a little more orangutan or a little more what we know as a primate, than sort of the more taller, upright, shaggy-haired creature that's described, like the Falk monster. So in my mind, I always pictured him as two different, possibly related, but two different species, you know?
Yeah.
You know, just the same as I feel like that the Pacific Northwest variety of Bigfoot, you know, Patty and her kin are probably definitely different than the Falk monster. So, you know, he sits somewhere between a skunk ape and a Bigfoot.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. Is it close enough where that is that kind of a vast enough difference in you know, in space where it's likely that these are different creatures? It's not like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, it's not the possibility that this thing could travel from Florida up to there, or is it small enough? Is it a large enough distance between the two that they could be pockets of different animals?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It definitely probably couldn't travel that wide of a range. That's a pretty good jump. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of swampy areas from Louisiana, you know, Alabama, Georgia, all down there, but it just seems too far. This would put these things just too much in the eyes of witnesses. So I think they've got to be more reclusive, which kind of isolates them into their own regions a little bit more.
All right. And then I guess to sort of head towards the close here, you do a great job in the book of addressing all these different theories as to what this thing is and sort of canceling them out. And we don't have to go through all of them, but I'll just sort of hit on them so people know what's in the book. I mean, you do a great job of sort of dispelling the idea that these are escaped circus animals, or that they are the creation of moonshiners trying to hide their stills, or that, you know, they're the result of moonshiners who've been drinking too much. And I'm sure that's probably something that a lot of ignorant people say right away. You know, oh, you got a bunch of country bumpkins down there, and they're drinking too much, and they see these things. I mean, from the stories in here, you know, I can't recall a single story in there where anyone was said to be out drinking and they ran into this thing. A lot of instances, there are a bunch of people together and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, and I didn't have a lot of reports like that. And in fact, anything that I deemed to be kind of sketchy or not credible, I didn't include in the book. So everything that's in there was what I believed to be the most solid sightings You know, there wasn't a whole lot of others, really, but there was some goofballs that said they saw it, and, you know, they were obviously just, you know, driving around in the 70s kids, you know, goofing around. I just threw those right out. So, you know, definitely that the whole notion of everybody's drunk down there, sure, they see weird things is totally wrong.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to clear that up, so we, because you know those people out there probably roll their eyes, going, "Well, what are you covering this for? It's stupid, you know." It's they need to really pick up the Beast of Boggy Creek to really get to the bottom of all this. And at the end of the day, it appears to me that we have some kind of Bigfoot-esque creature running around down there. I mean, it doesn't seem to add up in any other way to anything else, and it's a classic sort of tale of the paranormal, in a sense, where you get one explanation could explain one of the sightings, but it doesn't work for all of the other sightings until you finally get to the Bigfoot creature. So that, to me, is what I think makes it such a solid thing. As we said earlier, like about Carl Finch, he's an outsider, so he couldn't be susceptible to the mass hysteria. And, you know, this folk monster fever came along way after the Jonesville sightings, so they weren't trying to get on board and monetize the whole thing. So it's like, you, as you cancel out more and more potential reasons, you're ending up left with a Bigfoot-like creature, it seems.
Yeah, that was my conclusion. You know, you know, I'm not sure exactly what these folks saw, but they definitely saw something very strange, and they definitely saw something that they believed to be real, and that they described, you know, in faith to their fellow friends and family, in all honesty. And, you know, it's just, at the end of the day, when I got done with my research, I mean, you know, I definitely believe that there's something down there. There's gotta be. You just can't dispel all these sightings, you know.
And people should know, too, that, you know, this area now is, with the advent of the internet and stuff, there's groups down there who are on top of this thing, you know. This isn't sort of slipping through the cracks anymore, which is a good thing. Sounds like, you know, as the internet came along, we got a chance to really focus in more on the Falk area and the Boggy Creek realm, to get closer to getting to the bottom of this and actually collecting better sightings and really being able to investigate them better.
Oh, certainly. The way, you know, the exchange of information among area researchers in Texas and Arkansas and Oklahoma and so forth, you know, it's great, and it provides data and resources for everybody else to look at and to start correlating all these sightings together. And let's combine our notes. Let's combine all of our sighting reports and analyze those. And that this allows that. And I think that, you know, hopefully my book will provide a lot of data about, the Boggy Creek thing, and will help others, to expand their efforts to get to the bottom of it, you know.
I think so, yeah. I feel like the book will really light a spark under people, you know, who maybe had dismissed this previously as, you know, an aspect of the movie or something like that, or a creation of the movie, to take a second look at it, which is important. I had always been under the impression that it was just a series of Bigfoot sightings, and they made a movie about them. I didn't realize till I read your book that there's so much more to the story.
Exactly.
And since you know the area pretty well, this is always another question I sort of pose to cryptozoologists, you know, and I figure it'll be sort of a fun one to throw at you. Let's say, you know, money's no object. Let's say I won that big lottery they had last week. And, you know, I called you up and I said, "Lyle, whatever you need, let's get this thing by the end of 2012 or whatever, you know, let's just get this thing." How would you go about, you know, going after the Falk monster?
Well, I think that the best way to get a sighting, a photo, or a body, whatever you want, would be to get enough equipment and be able to go into the remote areas and stay for an extended period of time. You know, get away from you know, don't go to Falk, don't even go to Jonesville. I mean, don't bother driving the roads. I mean, go out there into the remote bayous in the Sulphur River Wildlife Management area where nobody else is, because if this creature, you know, is a real animal and is, you know, trying to remain elusive, that's where he's going to be. So I think if you had the resources, you know, you could just stay out there for 6 months on end, you know, and you could get yourself into the area where these creatures will most likely be, and then just kind of try various techniques, you know, try a little bit of a grid search, walking, try, it's easy to canoe around down in there because there's so much water, so that's an easy way to be silent and to move about. You know, try some still hunting, you know, set up in a tree stand, try things like that. So I think if you tried a variety of these things, you would certainly increase your chance of a visible sighting, because if you look at the sightings, you know, it was, you know, hunter and tree stands have seen it. People who were setting out trot lines who were in the river have seen it. People who were fishing in ponds quietly, they've seen it. So if you just kind of look at what were the circumstances around the most credible sightings in the woods, and just use those as your kind of starting point, I think that's what I would do if I had the money and the vacation time.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And it, having looked through the list of sightings, it appears a lot seem to happen, you know, between like the springtime and sort of like mid-fall. But then that stands to reason that that's when people are out and about and stuff. So you can't really base, you know, you can't really base too much on that and the idea that, you know, that the creature's around that time of year. Because, like, people really aren't out in the woods hunting and stuff, presumably, right, in the wintertime.
Not too much. I mean, you know, the one of the problems with the summer out there is it is incredibly hot. You know, last year down here, it was just miserable, you know, getting up to 108, 110 degrees. And if you get in a high humidity area, it is horrible. And they have what's called buffalo gnats down there. We were recently canoeing down the Sulphur River, and these things just attack you like a swarm.
Oh,
they're like
God.
Giant gnats. And it's miserable. So it's unfortunately kind of hard, because when the summer months hit, creatures may be apt to be moving around or whatever in the early morning, late evenings. But if you're going to be out there for days on end, it's kind of miserable. So, you know, spring and fall are the best times to get out. And of course, those end up being hunting season. So you got to watch out for, you know, people hunt deer. And, I mean, you know, a lot of hunters up in these areas. But that's what, you know, generates some of the sightings. But there has been some in the winter.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can move about in the winter, I mean, animals certainly are going to move around probably a little more, even during daylight hours or things like that, because it's not so miserable. The winters can be pretty cold here. People don't realize how cold it gets, but sometimes they can be fairly light. So you almost kind of have to be ready at a moment's notice. You know, I just kind of keep looking for the weekends that all of a sudden get to that right temperature where it's not too cold, not too hot, you know, and try to get out on the river up there or something, you know?
Yeah.
So, because, you know, really there's been a concentration of sightings, but they still exist all across, you know, all around year round. So
it sounds like, and based on what you're telling me and what you've researched, you know, this creature is still lurking out there. So hopefully, more information comes to light and you know, it takes its place amongst the more famous, well, it already is pretty famous in the realm of American cryptids. So
yeah,
this book will push it even further towards the top, I think.
Yes, I hope so. I have a certain childlike affection for the Falk monster, you know, that I've always had. So I'm honored to contribute to his further success and discovery.
You've teased a potential sequel to the book, But, you know, what's next for you? What do you have going on? I know you got the band and stuff, and chances are you're probably sort of balancing both of these interests and work. So, you know, what's going on? What's next for Lyle Blackburn?
Well, I'm kind of trying to figure out that. You know, I've had so many suggestions and so many of my own ideas, you know. I've thought about doing some documentary stuff. I want to write another book. I've got an idea for kind of a similar style book. I am interested in doing a sequel, and I think I could really do it, but I want to let it rest a while and ferment, you know, and see what comes up out of the first book. So I think down the road I'll probably end up doing a sequel, because there's already been some really cool stuff that I've discovered and some stuff that I didn't put in a book that people would be interested in. So I'm not sure what the next thing up to bat is, but I've got a lot of crazy ideas, so I'm sure it'll be big, whatever it is.
Exactly. That's always good. And of course, folks can stay tuned to monstrobizarro.com. That's your website, as well as folkmonster.net. Links are all over Banal of America, so be sure to check that out, folks. And on that note, we come to the end of this conversation. Lyle, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and giving us so much time. I really do appreciate it quite a bit. And as I said, you've done just yeoman's work here, really crystallizing the folk monster, the beast of Boggy Creek, and placing it in the proper context of cryptozoological history. And as we've discussed over the course of this conversation, really sort of straightening out a lot of the misconceptions that have surrounded this thing. So, I mean, you have done tremendous work, and I tip my hat to you, sir. Just an amazing job. For any serious student of the paranormal and cryptozoology, this is a must-have book, my friends. The Beast of Boggy Creek, The True Story of the Folk Monster. It's from our friends at Anomalist Books, so be sure to go and pick it up. Lyle, once again, kudos to you, sir. Outstanding work, and thank you once again for coming on the show.
You bet. Thanks for having me. It's been great.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to Lyle Blackburn for joining us on the program and giving us so much time. Be sure to check out his website, www.monstrobizarro.com. Pretty simple, all one word, monstrobizarro.com. And definitely go out and get your hands on The Beast of Boggy Creek, published by Anomalist Books. Just punch in Anomalist Books or The Beast of Boggy Creek to find out more information on this awesome book. And be sure to check it out. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback. But since we are well over our 10-day goal for this edition of the program, I am going to eschew BOA Audio Listener Feedback this week. Save it for another edition of the program. I've got tons of awesome emails and messages from folks with insights into the program, as well as guest requests and other fun stuff. I've got them all saved. Don't worry about that, folks. But like I said, since we are so late in the process, I want to hurry up and get this program out to people as fast as possible. Otherwise, it just may slip through the cracks for another few days. If you'd like to get in touch with me for a future installment of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, or you just want to write to me about the program, there are a number of ways to do it. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. Or head on over to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the contact button. And, of course, you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. We like to call it BOA's Paranormal Playground. Lots of fun discussions going on there with regards to the paranormal as well as pop culture. In addition to all that, I am of course on Facebook and Twitter. Just punch in B-I-N-N-A-L-L and you will find me there very easily. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good. and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And finally, I would be remiss if I did not plug Banal of America on Facebook. Just punch it in, Banal of America, you'll find our Facebook page. Please like us on Facebook, and you'll be given access to insights on the program as well as teasers for upcoming editions of BOA Audio. Up next, please allow me to thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. Since the last time you heard from me, we've got an all-new piece from Tina Senna sharing some of her ghost stories with the BOA readers, and we've got an all-new Shadow of the Shinigami by Marla Pena that is locked and loaded and ready to be posted at BOA very, very soon, and we've got a few other columns in the pipeline as well. We say it week in and week out, my friends, but it is the truth. If you're only listening to BOA Audio and you're not reading the columns at Banal of America, then you're only getting half of the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Now comes the time in the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to the BOA Audio listeners and ask you to make a donation to the BOA franchise. How do you do that? That's simple. There's two ways to do so. Head on over to Banal of America and click the PayPal button. You'll see it right there on the left-hand side of the screen. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, simple, and secure. But what if you don't trust the internet and you want to make a donation then via snail mail? Well, luckily we have a P.O. box that can take care of that as well. You can mail your donations to Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you spell Pinehurst, P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T. As always, and as noted here at the end of the program numerous times, if you are mailing a donation, please make it payable to Tim Banal and not Banal of America, since my bank will not cash those donations. And please include some means of correspondence so I can reach out to you and thank you for your donation. As always, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, commercial-free, and freely available for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of the program, we are welcoming back one of our long-time friends, talking about the crackpot historian himself, Adam Gorightly. Adam has a new book out titled Happy Trails to High Weirdness, and it is a collection of musings and anecdotes from Adam's lengthy career looking at the world of the paranormal and parapolitical. Always fun when I get the chance to sit down with Adam Gorightly for an extended conversation on the world of esoterica, and that is just what we have done. Happy Trails to High Weirdness, a conspiracy theorist's tour guide. That is, of course, the new book from Adam Gorightly, which we'll be discussing in depth on the next edition of BOA Audio. Be sure to tune in. And on that note, we close the book on this edition of the program. Once again, big, big thanks to Lyle Blackburn for coming on the show. And, of course, thanks to all you great folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners. You are the fuel that drives the BOA mothership. Thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.